So let me start with the summary. So even if someone is a bit late, it won't be too much of a problem. So I can take questions if there is any, since it's kind of the end of the chapter. So what we did was to introduce symplectic manifold as a way to talk about phase spaces and these are given by a two-dimensional manifold and a two-form which is closed and non-degenerate. Then we introduced Hamiltonian vector fields which are vector field associated to a function that generates them. And we had two ways two equivalent ways of thinking about them. So they are Hamiltonian vector field can be written in this form or in the symplectic picture instead of the Poisson picture, and they satisfy an equation like this, where the right-hand side is an exact one form. Then we look at kinematical symmetries, which are actions of a Lie algebra. In fact, one could do the action of a Lie group, but to simplify the presentation, I just use the infinitesimal version. So an infinitesimal action is a vector field on the manifold. So here we have an infinitesimal action of a Lie algebra on phase space. And the particular requirement is that to have a symmetry, a kinematical symmetry, is that this action is compatible with the symplectic structure, which means requiring that it is Hamiltonian. So, and this J here is the momentum map, which as we saw is a way to generalize notions of linear momentum, angular momentum, and so on to more general group actions. A particularly important property, let me write it like this, is a function on phase space valued in the dual of the Lie algebra. So in the case of translations, this is the dual of R3, which is R3 itself. And linear momentum is valued in R3. For angular momentum, we have SO3 as a Lie algebra, which as a vector space is just R3. And its dual is again R3, so angular momentum can also be thought as a vector. Now, we know that rotations transform under angular momenta transform themselves under rotations as vectors, so they are covariant, or as mathematicians say, equivariant, and the abstract way of writing these is the following. So this is an action on phase space. So I compare the momentum at two different points in phase space related by a symmetry. And so I can ask, how does the momentum transform? Well, it transforms covariantly, so under the appropriate action of the Lie algebra on the dual of the Lie algebra, which is this quadjoint action. Finally, we had all these things. A way to summarize all these things was to introduce this diagram, so I write it slightly differently than last time, but this way it makes a bit more sense. So we have three Oops. three Lie algebras related to which are related to each other. So we have the algebra of this, the symmetry algebra, which can be, then we have vector fields on phase space with their own Lie algebra of like of Lie derivations. And then we have functions on phase space which form an algebra with respect to the Poisson bracket. And all of these things are related to each other because we can map the Lie algebra on the Poisson algebra if we have an equivariant momentum map, or in fact, in this case, a comomentum map, which is the dual version of these that sends these an element in of the Lie algebra in the functions. But they contain the same information. They're just two ways to think about the same objects. Or we can take the action is what sends us the Lie algebra in vector fields, and it also respects the brackets. And finally, here we have, we found that Hamiltonian vector fields also form a homomorphism of Lie algebras. So all these maps are Lie algebras, homomorphism. Of course, this is the smallest, and this is the largest. So not every vector field is Hamiltonian, not every vector field comes from an action, and not every Hamiltonian vector field comes from a Lie algebra. So this is the smallest, and this is the largest. So this should summarize what we did so far. Today we changed topic a little bit. We moved to field theories before coming back to these kind of topics in the field theory context. So if you have questions, probably this about the first part, this is a good moment to ask.
Yeah. Why do you call it kinematical symmetry?
Because I haven't talked about any dynamics. There is no, this is just about the phase space structure. I haven't introduced any dynamics, so there is no compatibility condition here between the symmetries and the dynamics. So for example, we have a priori translation invariance in the phase space of a particle, but if you introduce a potential that breaks translational symmetry, magnetic field somewhere, and so on, it's not a dynamical symmetry anymore. So it's not, momentum is not conserved in that case, in that specific potential, unless this potential is, you know, if it's an external potential. So in that case, I would lose it, and so at the dynamical level, but it would still be a candidate symmetry for at the kinematical level.
Dynamical symmetry would be something that restricts what kind of Hamiltonian you can have on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would have to ask that the Hamiltonian is also invariant under the symmetry, which can be formulated in many different ways. So let's say a dynamical symmetry is compatible with the Hamiltonian. Here by Hamiltonian, I mean the one coming from the dynamic, right? So H. So, and there are different ways to write it. One is to say that the symmetry, the derivative of the Hamiltonian along the symmetry is zero, but this is also the same thing as saying that the momentum commutes, Poisson commutes with the Hamiltonian, which is the, in the quantum mechanical case, this is the one that is usually used. But they are the same, exactly the same thing. Yes?
So you said that we require rho to give Hamiltonian vector fields. Mm-hmm. How strong is this requirement? Is this some kind of compatibility between phase spaces and Lie group action? Or
Yep.
Do you have anything?
I'm not sure how to answer this. It's if I give you a crazy group, that there's no if I ask you to write down an Hamiltonian action for SO315 over the space of three particles, there's no obvious ways to do it. So yeah, it is restrictive. Except that usually we have in mind the obvious symmetries, and in those cases, the action is quite natural. But
so you can carve out like subgroups of.
Yeah, you usually know the symmetry of the system before writing down the Lagrangian, in fact, in many cases. But yeah. Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's move on and start talking about field theories. So what makes field theories interesting is that, first of all, they are infinite dimensional systems. And second, there is an interplay between the geometry in field space. So what is the space of available configurations we have? How are these configurations related by symmetries and so on? And space-time, which is the underlying space in which these fields live. So most of this course, in fact, its goal will be to explore this relationship between the geometry of field space and the geometry of space-time. So let me start by introducing some notation for the space-time geometry. So I will use the following letters. M is space-time, and I always think of M as time cross space. So some globally hyperbolic, if sigma has no boundaries, this would give us a globally hyperbolic space-time. And the way I would draw a situation like this, if I need to make a drawing, is some closed surface sigma, it's a topological surface. This could have some metric, and in the past could have some other metric, but topologically they are of course the same. And in between, they evolve in time along R. So is this picture clear? How to read it? Okay, so here I will call the time normal N, and that's all there is in this case. So here we have, this is the situation when sigma has no boundaries. For certain application, however, it is useful to consider a subregion of this sigma. A subregion that now we will have a boundary, right? So, and in this case, the drawing will be more like this. To avoid introducing too many letters, I will keep the same letters also in this case. So I make a different drawing about this situation and introduce some extra notations, but I will use the same letter that I use here. We just keep in mind that sometimes sigma has a boundary, sometimes it doesn't, and when it does, what I really mean is not that the universe has a boundary somewhere, but is more like a situation like this. So in this other case, I have sigma initial, sigma final, and now these are actually my spacetime M has two types of boundaries. So this is the case when C is the boundary, is defined as the boundary of sigma, which is it is non-trivial. So here, the situation is the following. My spacetime is still m cross sigma, My spacetime m is still r cross sigma, but now sigma has a boundary, which is, so I have a C initial and a C final, and these are called corners. We have boundaries and corners. And there are, in this case, there are two types of boundaries for m. So dm is now sigma in, sigma final, and b. B is my time-like boundary. And so I need to introduce not just a time-like normal, but also a space-like normal. So here, the way to think of this boundary is something like this, right? C initial is the intersection of the sigma in and B. That's another way to think about it. And B, as a manifold, is R cross C. Well, maybe instead of R, again, R is more like a T initial, T final. Oops. Is more like an interval in this case. Otherwise, M would not have boundaries. But again, I'm not going to be too fussy. I will jump from one case to the other, and it will be clear from applications which one we have in mind, and I will make drawings to remind ourselves if I'm thinking of sigma with boundaries, without boundaries, and so on. But just to, that's that, yeah.
I have a question about what happens when we don't have R cross something, but a general spacetime. Like, because the definition of globally hyperbolic is that there is one Cauchy, that there exists a Cauchy slice, isn't it?
Well, it's equivalent to asking that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Locally or?
Globally. I would say globally. Okay. We can check in Wald. Wald gives four different definitions of global hyperbolicity, but in the end, which are more abstract, but in the end they come down to requiring that a sigma exists for which that is the case.
So there exists like a time direct?
Yeah, there is some space evolving in time. Of course, you can slice it as you like, but the topology of sigma is always the same.
Okay.
Why did you write d sigma intersection? Why not just d sigma?
Oh, no, sorry. You're right. I meant this.
Oh.
Yeah. Which is also just... yeah, sorry. I am. Thanks. OK, so n is the time-like normal. S is the space-like normal. Now, at C, there is a particular type of normal, which is tailored to a codimension 2 surface. So a codimension 1 surface, like sigma or B, has a vector as a normal. A codimension 2 surface has a bivector as a normal. So this is epsilon AB NA SB minus SA NB divided by 1 minus N dot S. And it's normalized so that this is minus 2. So if you contract it with any vector parallel to C, you get, of course, 0. And if you contract it with n, you get back essentially Well, depends on, yeah, you get back S, right? You get back the other one. So as does this make sense? So why this is useful? It's useful because if you apply Gauss law on, you know, something like you integrate by parts, you go from M to sigma, you get something contracted with N. If you do it here, you get something contracted with epsilon, because you're going to the boundary twice.
Why do you normalize it like this? Minus
two. Yeah, because in my notes it's normalized like this, and I could put a square root of 2 somewhere, but I don't know if it is standard or not. I'm just try to be consistent in the notes, and this is how it came about, honestly. It's okay. So if we could say that if we think of sigma as a T equals 0 surface and B as a not equal 0 surface in some sort of, in some coordinates, so we can just think we have Minkowski, we write it in T times spherical coordinates, and we are in a situation like this, then NA dxA will be a normalizations times dt, whereas SA dxA will be something like this. The R, of course, here I'm assuming that the metric is diagonal. And epsilon with lower indices will be something like dt dr. Now, I haven't checked the signs and so on. So, oops. So you see that its Hodge dual is related to the area element, the volume element on sigma, on B, and on C. So that's also why these are useful, because you can use them to write volume elements on these surfaces. Okay, this exhausts what I wanted to say, because it's useful later to make drawings and relate, because we will be jumping from spacetime to Cauchy surfaces to boundaries of Cauchy surfaces at times a bit freely, so it's good to have some pictures in mind. And again, when sigma has a boundary, what I'm really meaning physically is that I'm looking at a subregion of some closed universe. Good. Now let's start talking about field space. Which is the configuration space for our field theory.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, for sure.
I don't know if it's like, maybe it's a very bad question, but the way that I understand it, you say that like we can always make the boundaries harmonic by just applying the like appropriate change of coordinates, but now like the manifold is like R times sigma, so like this change of coordinate, whenever like we want to, we have some boundary which is not necessarily time-like, we need to recover a manifold with full symmetries, that is like some four-dimensional manifold for that time is not separate, and then we can apply this change of coordinate, make boundary time-like, but then we want to make it again R times sigma, and this way would we like lose some part of manifold? I don't like why my boundary is always time-like.
I'm not sure I completely understand the question. I try to, let's see if the following helps answering. So I have some spacetime, and I assume that my spacetime has the is globally hyperbolic, which means it's a good spacetime to talk about time evolution in fact, in a Hamiltonian picture where I can think of the fields as evolving in time. So a globally hyperbolic spacetime is one in which equations of motion make sense as evolution equations. this type of spacetime necessarily is of the form sigma cross R. It doesn't mean that the metric is block diagonal, so it's not a metric on sigma times a metric on time. There can be mixed terms in the metric that mix dt and dx.
I guess like my question is like, and if we have a manifold that is not necessarily globally hyperbolic, then boundary can be not necessarily time-like.
Well,
and then we can look at the section that is like globally hyperbolic and make the boundary time-like. Can we do that?
Well, just a second. In this big manifold, I can take, I can carve out a region. And this region, if I necessarily will have, well, it will have a boundary. And this boundary can be, in general, split into two pieces. There is, in the simple cases at least, two space-like, so like the green region there, there is a space-like boundary, which is at the initial, there is some initial surface. Then it evolves, it does stuff, and then there is a final boundary. So it could even split into two pieces, that thing. No, the green tube doesn't really need, I don't want to consider those because it would be more complicated. But in principle, this thing could be more complicated. So there is two space-like boundaries and some time-like boundary interpolating in between them. And this is just, there could be null boundaries in principle in between. We will consider them as well. But a priori, this is not really restrictive. What is restrictive is, I'm saying, this is not so restrictive except for the fact that here I'm not putting null boundaries, but is an easy generalization. I don't quite see. The boundary is what it is. I pick it. It's not that I can rotate it afterwards. That would be a different region.
Maybe just a comment that Slava was saying you could do a coordinate transformation that takes the time-like boundary to a space-like one. But I think that this would not be possible. Like once the surface is time-like, you change the coordinates there, it'll always be time-like. But like when you take
It's an invariant concept. So when being time, so n is time-like if n is less than, in my metric, is less than zero, and it's space-like if this is more than zero, and in some cases it could be null when it is zero. But there is no change, this is a coordinate-independent statement. So there's no way to change this by changing coordinates, if that. I would have to really change the surface, but this would be a different region. So it would be a different type of operation. Okay. Field space. So what is the space of field configurations in general, in a general field theory? So I'll give you the general definition, then we will see some examples, and in fact, we will never really use this general definition, but I think it's good if you see it once. So, fields, so I will call field space F, is in general the space of sections of some bundle, where F is a bundle over M. So the picture that one draws is this is F, this is M, and a field is some map that takes a point X in spacetime and sends it inside my bundle where it takes some value. Now, typically, let's look at the scalar field. For a scalar field, the usual thing we have in mind is the case when F is M cross R, where if it is a real valued scalar field, well, let's say And so here, in this specific example, this would be, this direction would be R. And so this space of sections, in reality, is just maps from M into R, which is called the fiber in this case. If you want a scalar field, which is, if you want a vector field, maybe some Higgs or some a scalar field valued in vectors in some multiplet, you would put here your vector space. And then it's just a function between space-time and this vector space. So the thing is, this is, if you open a book in mathematical physics, they will start by introducing bundles. And they are just generalizations of structures like these, where instead of R, you can put more or less anything. And in fact, you can even twist it. So you don't need this to be a product space. Could be a more complicated space, like a Möbius strip that turn, if you want to, is the typical example. What we will care will be scalar field, gauge field, and gravitational field. So let's just give the example. Let's just say what the field spaces are in these cases we're interested in. We have the scalar field. We have Young-Mills. So Young-Mills is already complicated. I will not tell you what the bundle F is. It's not so easy to describe. So that's why I will not insist on this picture, because it can be complicated even in cases that we know what we are talking about. But let's just say that F, as far as we are concerned, in this case will be the space of one form over spacetime with value in some Lie algebra. It's not the most general situation, but is good enough for our application. So what is this? So this is A mu, A x alpha dx A tau alpha. Does that make sense in this coordinate writing? So we have a one form, which is valued in some Lie algebra. So it has an extra index, which is contracted with a Lie algebra generator. So usually, physicists talk about this. To write abstract formulas is a bit nicer to use this A, which is all put in one place. Yes?
Is that curly F or capital F?
This is curly F. Instead of functions on spacetime, which are valued in the reals, we get one forms on spacetime valued in G. This form have some special transformation properties, which is what makes describing F complicated. So I will not do. Like the straight F complicated. The curly one, we can take this one. Now for GR, oops, I've run out of space too early.
So we don't put by the gauge symmetry.
Yeah, so this is the off-shell thing. Yeah, very well. So here I'm talking about not the... I will distinguish between the physical phase space, the gauge invariant phase space, and this off-shell phase space, if you want, which is the one you start from. So in fact, the space of such connections, modulo gauge, would not be given bisection of some bundle would be a non-local. Would you would lose locality because you're modding out transformation that relate neighboring points because there are derivatives in the way things transform. And so it would not be possible to describe it as sections of a bundle. So that's why this as a starting point is nice. Because it's the because you have this local description, once you quotient out gauge, you use the locality of the description.
Does it happen the same thing if you impose equations of motion for the scalar field? Like, because in mathematics, we used to say that the phase space...
I'm not talking about phase space. This is configuration space over space-time. Okay. We will get there. We will get to phase space, and there we will have to impose the equations of motion and so on, and we will lose lots of those properties. But this is what enters your Lagrangian. If you want to write a local Lagrangian, you need field space of field configurations to be given by sections of some bundle so that you can write something local. And that's what you said. So in general relativity, you have some bundle which is the symmetrized tensor product between two copies of the cotangent bundle. Well, you do it over M. So what does this mean? This is a complicated way of just saying that these are symmetric rank two symmetric tensor, or never know what's covariant and what is contravariant, but anyway, with the indices low. and you are also at the condition that these are sections of F, so maps from M into objects like this. I should have written it here. Which are with the extra condition, which are of signature -1, 1, and in particular they are non-degenerate. So it's not all such sections. They are. It's an open subset of the space of this space of section. So this also tells you that general relativity has a complicated. Phase space geometry, just starting from here, and it is sometimes useful to consider a different formulation of GR, like the Einstein-Cartan formulation that Ruth introduced, and that would have a simpler F field space structure, but we will not use it, so I will not introduce it. Yes?
I don't understand why the bundle is a tensor product of cotangent. Because the curly F, the section should be the tensor product of cotangent space. Mm-hmm. GAB lives in curly F, not.
Yeah. So GAB at X lives in T star X of M cross T star X of M symmetrized. That's what this means. That's all these. This symbol means is that at a point, the fiber of the bundle is the product of two cotangent fibers.
Isn't GAB a section because it's a map from point X in the manifold to the fiber space?
Yeah, exactly. So at X, at the point X, the configuration that I get is valued into this tensor product. So if I want to write it, I could say that G at X, this is a bit of an overkill, but just because we are trying to, this would be this is what you would write. Does that make sense? The fact that I put an M here, it means that I keep the bundle has one base, which is M, and I'm just taking the product of the fibers. it's just a symbol to mean what one. So I wouldn't focus too much on these because we always know what we mean by them, but I just wanted to point out that there are ways to phrase even the known cases in that language. The one that I'm not doing is Young Meals, because it's really a bit nasty to find the right fiber bundle for which connections are sections. But it's possible to. And let me also mention that a useful example to keep in mind is the particle. So the particle can be thought as a 1 plus 0 dimensional QFT. So there is no space dimensions because they only live in time. And in this case, the fiber, so you have to imagine you have your space-time is just time. So if you want to tell me what is the configuration of a particle, what do you have to tell me? Where the particle is at any given time. So the F in this case is, let's say, R3, right? So that field space, and here we have Q of T. So here I write, if you want, G of X in some sense. Here I would write Q of T is the space of maps from R, my T, to R3. So this is, maybe I should call it what we were calling Q, configuration space, right, for the particle, which we can say in an example to be R3. So this is the same. Does this make sense? So we can even think of particles in a field theory in field theory terms. And we can even think of the parametrized particle in field theory terms. In that case, configuration, we would have tau instead of time as our, so, but the target space would be R4, not R3, because we were thinking of Q and T on the same footing in that case. So for the parametrized particle, that we did in the tutorial, F would be actually R4. Yes.
For the first one particle, why is F not R1 cross R3?
For this one?
Yeah, because isn't it the base cross the fiber?
Yes, sorry, you're right. You are absolutely right. So here I should have written, so here, let's say M equal time itself, so it's R. So this is M cross Q, which is R cross R3, and so this is R in Q. Yes, sorry, and so this would be R, which is, this is tau this time cross R cross Q, so to say. So this is T and Q. That's what would change in this descriptions. So I mention it because these are useful examples to test. Since we work so hard with this example, sometimes it's useful to go back to it and see whether what we're doing, how to test what we're doing in some simple case, and the particle is sometimes the simplest. Okay, so with, yeah. Sorry?
GRM cross the whole
here?
Yes.
Here M is, so in let's forget the fact that this is two copies, but the cotangent bundle is already M, is already a bundle, so it's already something on M. So to specify a point in T star of M, I have to specify a point of M and a point on the fiber. So this is already, it's not a product bundle, which is, so I cannot write it as M cross something, but locally it is of that form. It is TNX, comma, something in the fiber. Good. Okay, so next step is we want to do symplectic geometry on these spaces, let's say. That's more or less the goal. And so to do symplectic geometry, we need to be able to talk about vector fields, form, differential forms, and so on. So how do we do symplectic geometry on a space like that one? And in particular, what is the interplay of the differential geometry on spacetime and that on field space? Because now we have two manifolds which are important, both M and curly F. So this is so on M, we have the object, like the tools that we use to do Cartan calculus are D, the exterior differential, we have vector fields, and we can contract vector fields with form, and this is this I operation, which is the inclusion or inner derivative, depending on how you want to call it. And then we have lead derivative. So these are the three objects that we need to do Cartan's calculus on spacetime. Now, on F, what I want to do is to have the same objects, in fact, but now that live here. And I will, so let me introduce these symbols, and then I will show you how they work, how to actually use them to do computations. So to keep notation easy, what I will do is to, it's a bit annoying to write. One gets used to it a bit. So especially the D is the worst to write, but so we have, I just double the symbols, make them bold, so that is easy. They're easy to recognize. So they have the exact same meaning of D, I, and L, but now on field space and not on M. So the question is how to use these things, and also what is a vector field. So here, X was a vector field on M, and here these X is a vector field on F. So the question is how to think about all these objects and how to use them. So let me start from X. And I want to draw a parallel. So I will write on one side of the blackboard some formula for X, which is easy to recognize, and then write the analog for this double x. So for x, the way we want to think about it is as right? We have some components of my vector field at some point, and this is in some coordinates, this is the basis of vectors. So what is the analog in field space? We have our big X, which is evaluated at some configuration phi. Sorry. So this could be written like this. And now to determine a configuration phi, I have to tell you what is phi at every single point of the manifold. So here, to determine what was x at x, I had just to tell you an n component. Here I have to give you the value of phi of x over all, not just field space, but also spacetime in a sense. Because field space contains, knows about spacetime. So here, the analog would be the integral over m. So this is for the scalar field. Now I have to give a name to this object. I will use the following name. And in some sense, what I need to do is to there is some basis of vector field, and here the natural basis is to say how phi changes at the point x. So here is how where I move the point x, and here it tells me from how phi is the analog in field space. So here, the sum over the n components become an integral, because to specify the configuration, you need to specify it at every point. And this is the small variation. So here I have my manifold, m, a point x, and a vector x at x. So it tells me how each point, each coordinate gets moved. And here is the same thing. It tells me how every phi x changes by so this is delta x of phi. But to specify it, I have to tell you how phi changes at every point in spacetime. So that's why there is an integral here. Now, I want to use this to derive functions. Vectors are good to derive functions in particular. So how does a vector derive a function? Well, maybe I should have changed slightly notation, so this is at x, this is at phi. So I can write this x applied to f is right? And now I do the same here. So let me call, and these can be written in different ways. It's also equal to ix df. Well, it's also equal to lxf and ix df. So I want to be able, also in field space, to use all these types of formulas. But let's start from the obvious one. So let me call s. S here is a function on field space. So the typical example that I'm interested in is that of a Lagrangian. So let's be explicit, because things otherwise get very complicated very quickly. So here, what I want to do is to take so I have dl if I change phi. This changes by dx of phi. Then if l also depends on the first derivative of phi, the first derivative, how it will change? It will be the derivative of the variation. So this will be n plus other terms if there are more of these. So we see that. Oops, sorry. I should have. I apologize. Let me write these in two steps. I write it down here in two steps, because I think I need more space. So ds over d phi dx phi, by definition, is for these types of f, would be
dl over d phi of x dx of phi plus dl d phi of x d of dx of phi. So dA dA of x. So as we see, this object is a bit more complicated than x. Well, than just this derivative. So this has to be thought as a differential operator acting on this. In the lecture notes that I will upload right after, as soon as we are done, I will discuss this in a bit more detail. Usually, I refer to that. But in this course, this has to be thought as a differential operator acting on dx of phi because of this, right? So this notation is good as long as we know what we mean. It's not really a multiplication. One has to remember that there could be terms like that. Of course, I can integrate by part and get this to a boundary term. So if there is no boundaries, I can interpret this as a function as long as what I mean by it is the Euler-Lagrange derivative. So this is dl over d phi minus dA of dl over d dA of phi x. Plus a boundary term. So this subtlety is important only if there are boundaries. Otherwise, I can always integrate it by part and define it as a function, in fact. On space time. Okay? And this is reflected into boundary terms, which is this piece over here. So since I will be interested in boundaries, that's why I have to use this more general definition and not just say that this functional derivative is given by that, as is usually done. It's because I want to keep the boundary terms. So I have to do this slightly more general thing. Yes?
When we take the derivative of L with respect to partial A phi,
yes.
How do we know whether partial A is going to have one variation of phi or it's going to be variation of partial A of phi? Like, those two things come out.
These two?
No. Partial A and variation with respect to x.
Yes.
These two operators on phi, they take mute.
Oh, no. These you have to think as a block. This was, thanks for the question. So this is the component of my vector field in field space. So whatever that is, it's not really an operator acting on that. This is the name for the component of this guy. So this is whatever. For example, in the case of a, yeah, I don't want to introduce. I would have to introduce too much notations to make an explicit example. But this is just a lengthy notation. I could have called it. Well, that's the point. There's no good notation for this object, but you have to think of it just as its own function on space. So could. Yeah, could call it phi x. It is this guy, and so this is what this is. It's just its own function of space that tells me how phi x changes at that point. along this vector or field in field space. Is a change, is a small variation in the section I have. So, okay, this is a good, and it's maybe also a good place to conclude. So here, what I'm in field space, since field space is so complicated, x is something like this. So I can also, this is what I'm calling delta x of phi, is this variation over here, over field. So it's a, if you want, is itself a function on space. And so this is what it is deriving, this function on space. Thanks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess maybe I also feel like, so because here in the second derivative, it's almost like as if we're saying that we're treating the first derivative as a new field. And we're looking at the variation of that field.
Yeah.
But then how do we know the variation of the, how do we know like the vector, the variation of that new field is exactly the original, is the derivative of the original variation of the other?
It's because I'm not, so this is a way of computing what the variation is. If you have, you know, if you have your Lagrangian, which is d phi squared, suppose, what this is doing is computing L plus phi, this variation, minus L of phi, well, plus an epsilon, if you want, divided by epsilon, and taking the limit. So in here, it's clear that what you would get is the derivative of phi. So if I want to write the general formula, however, I have to do this somehow. So this is how you write it as a way to compute it. But they're not really independent. They always, there is only one section of your bundle. There is not one section and its derivatives and so on. They're not independent. They are all related to each other by derivatives in the obvious way. So these are, you have seen many times, right, to compute the equations of motion and so on. It's not different. So, but here I'm just trying to have you think about it in a slightly different way, more geometrical. But it's the same thing that you were used to. OK, so next time we will start from here and do introduce the D and the lead derivative in field space, which are the next steps.